And it's Cliff Groth and Tom Whedon, both from the WBA. They do our ABIB inspections for the state of Wisconsin. And I think it's a very valuable service. I'm the DOE of WISN-TV in Milwaukee, and we take part of that program. I believe it's really worthwhile. It's not only do they point out what you're not doing right, and what you're doing right, they're very, you know, they'll compliment you too, but it also helps, you know, you don't for 3 years, right, Cliff? 3 years you don't get inspected, so by the FCC. So you guys want to come on up?
I'm Tom Whedon, and I'm Cliff's sidekick today. We're going to talk about the Alternative Broadcast Instruction Program. Can you guys hear me okay? No? Speaking slowly would help? I don't know. Get on the mic. That's about all we can do here.
I have to find out where to put my head.
You can always depend on the closed captioning. I want to thank ENCO for providing reasonably good captioning. I have a captioning story. I was chief engineer at WMTV here in Madison for many years. And when the FCC requirement came that anytime somebody says something on the TV, it's got to appear on the screen somehow, whether it's a full screen graphic or closed captioning. So we got one of the early voice recognition units for closed captioning. So somebody would have to put on a headset and read 15 minutes of scripts into the thing to train the system for your voice. So we had four or five people who could do this, and I was one of them. One day we had a severe weather situation, so we were breaking into programming. I happened to be available, so I put the headset on and called up my voice profile, and everybody went on the air and talking about severe weather and tornadoes, and was not doing too well because everything I heard from the air signal, I had to repeat into the microphone, and the system had to caption what I was saying rather than the person on the air because I had trained it from my voice profile. So things are going relatively well, and I said the word meteorologist because the meteorologist was being introduced, and I looked down at the TV set, and the closed captioning said, "Mean urologist." There's no delete button. It went out that way. So this is doing much better. So this is an overview of the Alternative Broadcast Inspection Program. And one of the things we're trying to avoid here is you panicking when somebody at the front desk, if you still have a front desk, says, "The FCC's here." Okay, this has only happened to me once where an FCC agent, actually two agents showed up, and this was the morning after we turned off our analog TV transmitter for the last time. It was the digital transition, and for whatever reason, we had to go a day early than everybody else. So we turned off the transmitter at 11:59 p.m., and I was in the next morning, and I heard over the PA system at about 8:30, "Tom Whedon, the FCC is in the lobby." This is the worst day of my life. So I went up front, and there were two nice gentlemen from the commission, and they weren't there to inspect, they were there to congratulate us on our digital transition. Well, that's a relief. That's usually not why they show up. So during the COVID era, roughly between March 2020 and April 2022, the FCC suspended most station inspections. But in April of 22, the Enforcement Bureau told the field offices that they can resume random inspections. So they would start showing up at your radio or TV station. So how can you prepare for an inspection? You think you're running a decent, tight ship, but you're not sure? How do you get ready for something like this in case it happens? Well, until recently, you could use the FCC's self-inspection checklist, but I'm holding an old one here. You used to be able to download this. It's not available anymore, which is good because the last update was 2009, and it still referred to a lot of analog television rules and some other obsolete radio rules, so that wasn't available anymore. Now, this past March, the SBE and the NAB put together a new self-inspection guide for TV and for FM radio, and those are available to SBE and NAB members for download. So you have access to that. And we just found out yesterday that they've come up with the AM self-inspection guide. So that's a good thing, shown here.
FM.
That's the FM version. Or you can use the Alternative Broadcast Inspection Program. We call it ABIP. The ABIP program was established in 1996 by the FCC and various broadcast associations to allow broadcast stations to identify and correct potential compliance gaps on their own. So how does this work? Well, in the case of Wisconsin, a station contracts with their WBA. It varies from state to state, so get a hold of your state broadcast association to see if they have this program. The costs are based on the type of station. A full power station has a different rate schedule than a low power. WBA would then contact the contract inspector, so they would contact me for television and Cliff for radio. And then next step is the inspector contacts the station, which is usually the chief engineer or the chief operator. Sometimes it's the general manager to set up an inspection date. Now, from the time that your station signs the contract and pays the fee to WBA, there's a 150-day window that opens. So basically, you have 5 months to schedule an inspection. And if you save the signed contract, that's kind of your placeholder in case an agent does show up. You say, no, we're working on it. And so that's helpful. The inspection occurs on the agreed upon date. The inspector will show up. And it's a friendly visit. It's not a, you know, it's not a controversial thing because we're there to help you. The inspector will attempt to help the chief operator correct any deficiencies that they see on the checklist. And if there are some discrepancies and they can't be resolved on the date of the inspection, then the station has another 60 days to get those corrected. So that's another 2 months. So that's a total of 7 months to get all this done. And the important footnote here is that if there is something wrong that you're out of compliance on, the inspector does not inform the WBA or the FCC. It's just between your station and the inspector. So that's very important. It's confidential. After the deficiencies have been resolved, if there's something wrong and somewhere within that 2 month grace period, the station can either request a re-inspection on site, which is another charge, or if it's something simple that can be done photographically or a document uploaded by email, as long as there's evidence to the inspector that issues are resolved, then that's fine. So if all is well, whether on site everything's fine that day or the station corrects anything that was found, the inspector files a compliance form with the WBA, and then WBA then issues the station a compliance certificate. This is the form that we send back to the office, and then you get the official certificate from WBA, which you either post or put it in your binder with all your other licenses. And that compliance certificate is good for 3 years. So if the station is not in compliance by the end of the 60 days, no compliance certificate is issued, and nothing happens. The inspector does not snitch, does not rat you out to the FCC, it just, we all go away and you have to deal with any possible inspection that happens later from a real FCC agent. If a field agent visits the station and you show him your ABIP compliance certificate, the agent will wish the station a good day and leave. Have a nice day. Usually. This is not a 100% get out of jail free card. Some exceptions are if there is an interference issue, a complaint, either from another station saying you're interfering with them, or you know the pilots trying to land at your local airport are hearing Taylor Swift in their headset, that's a problem. Other non-compliant operation reported to the FCC in a complaint, you know, obscenity or, you know, pick a rule. In this case, FCC can and will inspect regardless of the ABIP status. Here are some of the recent violations, kind of to get your attention. These are from the broadcaster's desktop resource. Back in July, a couple of translators in Tennessee and Mississippi failed to file a timely renewal action application Their license expired, but they stayed on the air. Both of them were fined $6,500. Also in July, this is non-commercial TV in Mississippi. Eight stations failed to update their quarterly issues program lists in their online public file, jeopardizing their license renewal. They were fined $5,600 and ordered to implement a compliance plan so that this would not continue to fall through the cracks. They did get their licenses renewed, so that's good. Also in July, this was apparently a big month for non-commercial television, Oregon public TV stations failed to place quarterly issues and program lists in their online inspection files. And they were fined $16,500 and ordered to implement a compliance plan. That's one of the things that the commission likes to do. And their licenses were renewed, so it wasn't a fatal problem. Here's a fatal problem. In June of this year, a field agent attempted to inspect a low-power FM in Florida. The station was off the air, failed to make the station available for inspection, and then the licensee's president was uncooperative and did not return the agent's calls. They were fined $25,000, and if not paid within 30 days, they'd be referred to the DOJ for enforcement. I did not follow up on this to see if they paid or what happened. Back in May, here's an AM station that apparently sold some land that their tower was on, because that's pretty lucrative. They put up a long wire antenna and applied for an STA. After 5 years, they were still on the temporary antenna, never renewed their STA, and their license was canceled. So keep those STAs up to date. I think this is the last one. April of this year, non-commercial FM in New York aired what were considered commercial announcements, did not provide proper sponsorship identification. They were fined $25,000 and ordered a compliance plan to be implemented. So what do we look for when either Cliff or I show up at your radio station or TV station? We will look to see that your licenses are up to date, whether they're posted at your control point or at the transmitter site, or in a binder that is readily available. We want to see your license, your renewal postcard. The new checklist that came out also has us checking things like STL licenses to make sure the coordinates are correct for studio and transmitter sites. Sometimes those are switched, or they're totally wrong, or the STL was upgraded from analog to digital and the license was never updated to reflect that. A new thing on the new checklist that just came out, if you've got a backup antenna on your tower that can be used in an emergency, that's considered an auxiliary antenna, and that needs to be licensed. So if you don't have a license for your backup antenna, you should get your consulting engineer to work on that for you. We'll look for the renewal postcard, because the license is typically not updated, but you'll get a postcard in the mail. That should be put in your binder or posted. The chief operator designation letter and the most recent transmitter proof needs to be in your files. We'll also go to the transmitter site, make sure your tower is in the proper location as it, does the license match the GPS that I'm holding next to the tower. We'll check tower lighting, fencing, especially if you're an AM station, tower paint if necessary. Your power determination, if you say that you're a 10 kilowatt station, can you prove you're at 10 kilowatts, even though your meter on the transmitter says 10? How do you know that's accurate? We'll also ask about remote control and calibration. Do the operators or the announcers have remote control of the transmitter? Or if you're the only engineer available, do you get the phone call from the remote control system if you go out of tolerance? Or if your tower light fails. We'll also want to look at the emergency alert system to make sure you're monitoring your correct radio assignments according to your state ES plan. Make sure that you're logging the tests, both sent and received, and that you should have some sort of record, whether it's electronic or on paper, showing all the weekly tests, the monthly tests that you have sent and received. And the chief operator or the designate, if you have an alternate, needs to check that every week and actually sign off on it, because that's a That's a requirement. And if, for whatever reason, a test was missed, either your traffic department failed to schedule one, or one of the stations you monitor didn't send one for one reason, there has to be a note in that EAS log as to why that happened. If it, you know, you didn't receive one from your LP1 station, you should have some sort of record, either, you know, email conversation with the originating station, or, you know, maybe you got an email from Chris Tarr. If it's a statewide problem, make sure that's in your log. What else we have here? Other items are specific to AM, FM, and TV stations. Obviously, you're not going to inspect correct PSIP tables on a radio station and things like that. So television-specific items is your ATSC pilot frequency near where it's supposed to be, because you can't really see a carrier anymore on a digital signal. Are your PSIP tables correct for all your program streams that you're transmitting? Can you determine that your modulation eye pattern is clean, or is your signal-to-noise ratio or modulation error ratio acceptable for a good signal? And are you complying with the CALM Act? Are your commercial loudness, do you have some sort of audio processing or other means to make sure you don't have loud commercials compared to the rest of your programming? This is my screenshot of channel 14 and a look at their pilot frequency, and that's 309 kilohertz, give or take a few hundred cycles above the bottom of the channel. And this is a look at the PSIP tables for their, six or seven different program streams. So let's go to Cliff for the typical radio inspection. I'll keep it.
You could do that. I've got a copy of things here. The bottom line is the FM and AM checklists are a little different. I've done one TV. That was interesting because I'm not a TV person. But getting back to the actual checklist that we use, the checks that I've done recently have been based on my personal checklist, which I've used and regenerated over the years. The checklist is based loosely on the original checklist, and I just go down the list, and Tom has referred to some of them already, but we basically look at your papers, make sure you've got them. Now, before I even start an inspection, I've already inspected you. I go on FCC Info, and I get a copy of the license if it's available. And a lot of the stations I've checked don't have a license on file with the FCC. They're not in the database. So the first thing I'll ask is, where's your license? Well, some of them are a little more organized and they have a book. And some of them aren't as organized and they find the one from 1974. Which is perfectly legitimate. I always find on the FCC info list, or the FCC's final list, I find the renewal. The renewal means they have a license. Now I gotta get a copy of the license, or I may walk in with a copy of what I think is their license, if that's what I got from the commission. And that's where I start my inspection. We talked about towers. Is the tower at the right place? And I found towers. In fact, one of my own towers was 1 mile away from where it should have been. It was an easy mistake because the consultant that did the application was reading a 7.5 minute geological survey and was one road off, 1 mile off. And when we had to do the ASR requirements, the GPS and the tower did not agree. So we ended up, well, I corrected that in the FCC database, but things like that have happened. I find stations that are 50 feet off. That's not too bad because it's less than a second. But if it's way out of line, what I found, I'm using now Google Earth, and I can get right to a tower base, and I can get within a second without much trouble. And that's what I use as a reference. Now, once I've determined that they indeed have a license, and sometimes I'm doing an AM/FM, so I'll combine the inspections. I'll make sure first there's a chief operator letter. And that one is important, and that is often missed or messed up. What I'm finding is they do have a chief operator letter in the file. And I also like to see an alternate, because no chief operator runs 365 days a year, doesn't take vacation. And a requirement is you check logs once a week, not once every 3 weeks. It's once a week, and that becomes a stickler. And I have to insist that the station meet the requirements, and also if I see the designation letter doesn't have the people on it that should be there, like somebody has moved to another station, I have them update the letter while I'm there. That takes care of the problem. My idea of inspecting is we go in, and if we find a problem, we'll do whatever we can to fix it right then and there. There are some things that we can't fix then and there, like if there's a meter that's not right, a piece of equipment that's not working, then I'll ask for, within the 60-day limit, some kind of a physical reply, an email. Email is the way we're doing everything now. In fact, I don't send out mail at all. All of my certificate information and even my checklist, when I'm done with a checklist, my checklist, I send a copy to the station so they can see what I've checked off and what I found. So make sure that your chief operator designation is up to date. Now the next biggie that we find is the station is required to have a weekly station log. Now, what is a weekly station log? Well, according to the Alabama Broadcasters Association, which we refer to a lot because we get some of our information from them, the log has the EAS activity. That's a given. If you don't have that, you got a problem. But any malfunctions of tower lighting or major transmission issues or adjustments. Okay, so you went off the air. That should be noted. Or you were operating at reduced power for less than the 10-day where you have to file. That should be noted. And then when you go back, it should be noted on your weekly station log. Now, how do you keep this station log? I like to see a three-ring binder arrangement. I'm now accepting, and I've gone to, and I don't think you have, Tom, I'm using Google Sheets to keep some of my records. That allows for other engineers in the organization to see it. I like to take meter readings once a day, although, as Mark, you pointed out, we don't have to take meter readings anymore, but how do we prove that we're operating properly if we don't take down some kind of data? And as Tom pointed out, or we were discussing this at the table at lunch here today, okay, the station has been having a problem for a year. They haven't been operating at the proper power level, and the FCC does walk in. What do they get? A 364-day fine at $10,000 a day? But if you can prove every day that you're in compliance, you're a lot better off. And the other thing it shows is you are doing the job of keeping track of what's going on in your station. Other documents that we look at beside the licenses and the CO letter are the proofs, which Tom referred to. The proofs are another issue, and Mark Persons and I were discussing that earlier. We do have an annual NRSC requirement for AMs, but we technically don't have an FM proof requirement anymore. I'm accepting, if there's a new transmitter, the test documentation on that transmitter that came out of the factory. Mark challenged me on that, and I get challenged when I go to stations. I know Jim challenged me on a rule when I was at his station. And that's not bad. We need to challenge each other because we don't know everything and we're not perfect. But the bottom line is I'll accept the proof information that the transmitter manufacturer sent with the transmitter. Now, Mark responded that it's not really a proof in the field, and he's right. You should take an occupied bandwidth with a spectrum analyzer, and that's a question mark. But that's where I am on that. If you make changes, and these are some of the interesting things, the old rules are if you change the oscillator or the output amplifier, you had to prove that it worked. And that would require a full proof, almost like a factory proof. We don't have SCA anymore, but we used to have to do a proof if we put on an SCA or RDS. And that's another area where it wouldn't be a bad idea to get a spectrum picture of what's going on and put that in your files as information that you are in compliance with the rules. When I do an FM inspection, I check modulation. I also check pilot injection, RDS injection, and I look at the carrier out to 100K with my Pyra PA275 FM analyzer. Actually, it does a pretty neat job. Gives me a picture that I put in my computer, and I send that along with the documentation for the station. It lets me know what the stereo injection is, what the RDS injection is, and what the modulation looks like if we're over-modulating. And speaking of modulation, I'm sorry I'm taking a lot of your time here, but there's two rules about modulation, or three rules actually. AM positive can go to 125, negative 100, with no peaks of frequent reoccurrence, whatever that is. On FM, we allow the stations to go overmodulated above 75 kilohertz or 100% by one half of the total injection levels. Pilot, RDS, and subcarrier. So I give it that most of that, and it's one half of that number, not the total of that number, it's one half of that number. Usually comes out to about 105. Now, I use a slop factor of 5%, which is the accuracy of modulation monitors, the old style. So if they're making it below 110%, I won't complain too much. But if it's over 110% recurrent, I'll say, back off a little. Now, if you've got a low power FM station, the rules are different. And I didn't know this, I had to learn this through someone else that threw it up at me. Low power FM stations are not allowed to go above 100% at any time.
Really?
That's in the rules. But you're kind of looking at me like, I didn't either. But there is a rule that says the low powers can't go above 100% modulation. Just a little known factoid, if you will. Part of the station logs, and getting back to that, is the tower lighting requirements. Now, that becomes an issue in more than one way, because some stations own their towers, some towers are owned by others, but the station is still responsible for that tower if they're licensed to that tower. So how do we get in compliance with that? Well, first, if you own the tower, you better check tower lights daily, or you better have an automated system that tells you when it's out. But the other one that I find the most frequently missing is the quarterly tower light system inspection. And that is, you check your tower lights every day, you might look at them, you might check the metering on your remote control, but do you check the total system once every quarter? That is a requirement, and that should be a station logging requirement. I've made a recommendation at a few stations where they have a tower where it's owned by others, and or I have one situation where we literally had two towers side by side, and one of their antennas, the main, was on one tower, and the auxiliary, which was licensed, was on the other tower. One tower they were checking, and I had the engineer do a quarterly tower light checklist and tape it to the tower light controller, so he's got a record. That, to me, was a good idea of how to do the quarterly requirement. You could do it any other way, but that was a way I recommended. Now we get into the problem of it's owned by American Tower or Phoenix Tower or whomever, and it's not your tower. Now what do you do if the tower lights are out? You still could get fined unless you're covered. And what I'm asking is, do you have a contract with the tower company of who's responsible for the tower lights and the tower lighting system? If you don't have a they'll tell me, we have a contract, it's at the corporate office. And I ask that a copy of that be in your station license information so that you're covered if that question comes up legally. Now again, you won't get an inspection for 3 years if we pass you. But you could, if there's an interference problem, or if somebody calls that the tower lights are out and you don't have a NOTAM. That can be a problem. Now, I ran into a station that had tower lights out for several months. Usually, it's been the policy of the Green Bay office, FAA, to issue NOTAMs for a period of 1 month. This station has a NOTAM for 1 year. I've never seen it, but as far as I was concerned, they were in compliance. But you better have that paperwork done and better have filed either monthly or, like I found out from Green Bay, that they're now doing it on an annual basis. And the issue is we can't get tower climbers to do the work, or they can't get the parts for the strobes, or whatever the excuse is. And that's the real world we're running into. The other thing we look at is paint. Well, we have color charts for that. I don't have one.
Tom, do you? I don't have one.
You know, we could look at it. If it looks pretty good, we'll say it's pretty good. If it's in rough shape, it's time to get painted. And usually what I hear, it's scheduled. Well, okay, get her done. When I finalize a report to the station, I write up a letter of things I found that are marginal, and I put that in a letter format to the station manager or engineer that doesn't go to Michelle. It's not reported to anybody else but the station. But it is a record that they were notified. And, you know, if you're notified, you know, pay attention at least. AM towers require fencing and radiation limits. You don't technically have to have a fence around an FM tower, but if somebody climbs the darn thing and falls off, then where are you? So that becomes a question mark. Transmitter power, I want you to explain TV power. I'll explain some of the power things I've gotten into and how I'm handling it. AM power, either directional or non-directional, is pretty easy because it's on the license and it tells you what the impedance of the tower is, and from that you can calculate the power based on the I squared R. So we can figure out the power. With directional, you got 8% slop, 5 kilowatts, and then 5% after. But the big thing is it's fairly easy to get AM power. Now, I've run into a station where the power level changes drastically. Okay, and it happens to be in the Mississippi River Valley or on the floodplain, and the impedance of the tower, and it happens to be a slant wire, a shunt fed tower at the same time, the impedance goes all over the map. So how do we determine power? Well, the new solid state rigs have a kilowatt, and this happens to be a kilowatt meter on it, so they're reading power, and I've been able to determine what the match is on that antenna, or I've been able to set it, and this is work I've done outside of my ABIP work. But the bottom line is I set them up with a network, and I've seen a couple of slant wire stations where they have T networks in front of the slant wire, and you can use the VisWire meter on a transmitter and keep the VisWire low. That keeps your power meter in check, and it's to my way of thinking, you're in compliance because the calibrated output meter, and if the VisWire is down, you're within reasonable power tolerance. Now, that's a got you. Technically, you should be able to read the tower base impedance and make the calculation, but tower base impedances change summer to winter, and they change with a wet and dry season. It's not the same. For FM power, we rely on the output meter. Hopefully they've got a bird as a secondary meter, a bird or a coaxial dynamics or whoever meter, and that to me is acceptable. Tom, FM power.
For television, what we look at is the license will say what the ERP is supposed to be, and transmitter power is as needed to achieve ERP. So I need to be able to see a document from the antenna manufacturer or the engineer that set up the transmitter. What's the gain of the antenna? What's the line loss? What's the loss through the channel filter? And what the input power is supposed to be at the transmitter, at the input to the channel filter to achieve ERP. And so I think in every inspection I've done so far, except for one station, everybody's got a new transmitter. You know, it's less than 3 or 4 years old because of all the repack and all the channel changes. And so the new transmitters say, okay, your power output is 38.2 kilowatts. Well, that's fine. So there's, and that number is relayed digitally to your remote control, so there's no calibration going on. But how can you prove that that 38.2 or whatever I said is accurate? So there should be a secondary means of reading your power, and that typically is a bird through line section on your coax somewhere, or an Agilent power meter that can verify what your transmitter thinks it's doing. The really, really old school method is you run your transmitter into the dummy load with water going through the load, and you put two thermometers on there, and you measure the input temperature and the output temperature, and you look up the power on a graph. I don't think anyone does that anymore, so we'll just let that go. How much time we got? We're under 5 minutes.
I'm sorry about this. Sorry, Tom, I took all your time here. I got carried away. But we got to get to EAS, so take over.
Sure. One of the requirements is that you need to have the EAS handbook at your control point. And
the right one.
2023 is the most recent version that we're aware of. And it has to be filled out for your particular station. This is a fillable PDF file. So you need to put down, you know, who's the contact person for EAS problems. This says that emergency action notifications are relayed automatically. National periodic tests, which I'll get back to in a second. How an RMT works, if there's anything the operator's got to do to forward the RMT, you put the instructions in there. If it happens automatically, you check the other box. This is how to originate a weekly test. All this needs to be filled out. You should also have your state EAS plan on file. It's not a requirement in the checklist, but this is a really good idea because, at least in the Wisconsin plan, it lists the stations you're supposed to be monitoring for your particular county. So in this case, for Dane County stations, you should be monitoring WERN, the state relay station, and WIBA, AM or FM for your LP1. Optional is Madison Weather Radio. So what I typically do, I says, let me hear your two monitored radio stations. And so they'll go to the receivers and turn those on so we can make sure those are correct. What else haven't we done yet? About the National Periodic Test, there's not going to be one this year. But you're still required to file the FCC EAS Form 1 by October 4th. That's not in my checklist here. There is a link to get to that online. I don't have it. Our last slide here is going to have a list of resource websites. That's not included in there, but I printed out several of them. It's on the side table over there if you want a copy of all the links. Did I miss anything on the NPT for the EAS?
No, I think you're good. I want to say one other thing about EAS, and the thing I'm finding in the field. I found the station's not logging properly. One receiver might not be working, and it's not being recorded. Well, 1 week, not bad. The second week, there better be a note in your log. But the other thing, and the broadcaster's desktop resource just had an article which I subscribe to, but I have a question about. You really must listen. I've heard EASs that aren't at the right level, or they're so badly distorted you can't understand them. Some of it is the systems that are providing the audio, but you must listen. Now, the desktop resource said that the EAS equipment, and we got our DASDAQ man down there, we were talking to him at the table this noon. Where do you put the EAS equipment in the chain? This article says put it before the transmitter. Well, I say put it in front of the AGC so that the level can be corrected if it needs to be corrected. And that's where you don't want it as the last thing, because you got to get the level right. You got to have AGC and limiting in there to correct any errors and possibly correct the level differences.
All right. We're just about out of time here. This is a list of resources. Most of these are printed out if you need to get those, if you can't catch them on your camera. Any quick questions?
We answered everything.
There's one over here. Brief pause. Will this come out of our time?
Would I be correct if I state that 100% modulation also applies, the 100% limit also applies to translators?
Did you hear that?
Yes, the 100% modulation limit for low power FMs also applies to translators. Is that what I heard?
Yep.
Okay.
That's how I understand the rules now.
Anyone else?
I question why they have that rule, but it's still in the rules, and until we get the FCC to change it.
So you think that the EAS should be before the AGC, but if your source's audio is distorted or too low, too loud, whatever, the AGC is not going to do much good. Correct.
Well, you have a way to adjust the output of the. Are you speaking of a bad receiver or a distorted receiver? There are adjustments of level. I know the SAGE unit. You can adjust the input level.
Correct.
And I think DASDAQ, you have the same thing.
But what if your AGC has a problem? Then your EAS isn't going to work.
Well,
I think that was the whole idea of having the EAS before the transmitter.
Well, most systems now would be a plus four. The input of the AGC should be set within a nominal range of that plus four.
For those of you who still have tube-type FM transmitters, I just know that the output meter is going to be inaccurate. I found that over and over again. The fix for that is you tune the transmitter for best efficiency, go with the efficiency number of the transmitter's manufacturer, and adjust it for the right amount of power at that point. Then calibrate the output meter on the transmitter, and you'll find that that's your best method. And that rings quite true with a bird watt meter that might be your other test instrument.
Mark makes a good point, I forgot to mention that about power. On the older tube transmitters, we always got a calibration chart. Using that calibration chart is a good idea. But there we have tubes with voltage and current, so we can multiply and get power in versus efficiency to get power out.
All right. Thanks, everybody.